Please, come into my room.
Welcome back to another amazing and informative episode of The Mustache Room. You're about to enter The Mustache Room. I'm your host, David Benn. On today's episode, my good friend Chris rejoins the podcast. We talk about mixed martial arts and how there is some interest, some movement in the way of psychedelics for performance enhancements and other areas that could benefit fighters. I'm a big fan of mixed martial arts. I practice jiu-jitsu, but by no means am I a full-fledged mixed martial artist. However, it's an awesome sport, and I love those guys. So you'll learn about that. Wifey Jill stops back by to teach us about a new mushroom. You also learn about the most identifiable mushroom out there, the one that influenced Santa Claus and Mario Brothers and some other cool stuff that I'm sure you're familiar with. So here you go.
This is the second return guest. We had Patrick twice, and now we have Chris returning to the Mustache Room. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
I agree. I concur. Chris, first and foremost, it's good to have you here. It's good to have you in person. But I want to make sure that I don't forget to address, you had some questions about the monotubs that are sitting close to the Mustache Room. And I want to make sure that I address your questions about the monotubs.
Well, it's a good place to start. So with the albino strain that you have, you mentioned that reducing the light exposure kind of helped. Talk to me a little bit about that and kind of what you changed.
Yeah, good question. So in the previous episode, I can't remember which one, we talked about albino penis envy, the strain. And actually, I have some information that I got recently as to why that might be the best strain to play with. But it's hard to cultivate. In terms of its potency, it's really sought after and provides some good effects. But it's kind of hard to get it to work the way the other strains do. So what I had was I did just a normal monotub with a good ratio of spawn and casing. And it just took forever to fruit. It took forever for any mushrooms to start coming out. I got little pins, but they never evolved into anything. They kind of turned green. They oxidized almost immediately. Mm-hmm. I got a handful that actually made it to decent-sized mushrooms. They look like penises, right? Phallic structure. Yeah. But I noticed that they just weren't really doing much. So I figured albinos don't like the light. Ostensibly, I've never met. I had an albino cockatiel. No? I said cockatiel. Cockatiel as a child. Shitty pet, shitty bird. I'm sure not all albino cockatiels are like that, but he was useless. That's my only exposure to an albino.
All right.
So what I did is I turned off the light. I decided to let them quell in the dark a little bit. Maybe they're scared of the light, and I've gotten a little bit more growth out of them. So it's an ongoing experiment. I don't know at this point whether that was just kind of like some happenstance or whether I influenced that, but that's what I've noticed so far.
When you're cultivating, yes. I've noticed that I had a period where every new piece, after 2 days or so, every new, I guess actually mushroom, after 2 days or so would turn green.
First of all, talking to the mic just a little bit more direct.
Will do.
Oh, there it is. So sweet. So basically when the mushroom is, don't worry about the green, it's oxidizing.
Sure.
So it's like a bluish green, right?
Is it like a temperature thing, a humidity thing, or just happens?
Once the mushroom's done growing, like once you break it away from the mycelium, it's going to start oxidizing pretty quickly. So it just means it's done growing or it's detached from the active mycelium.
Mm, okay.
And like I said, I was telling you earlier, a lot of the pins that I had with albino penis envy, they would just turn green almost instantly.
Right.
So they just stop growing. They kind of... they're just failed pins, just never never amounted to much.
Okay. You know?
Like, had maybe some potential as a kid, but they just got swept up in some bullshit and just never amounted to anything.
Ah, yeah.
Those fucking penises.
Sounds familiar.
I'll have to report back as to ultimately where I stand, but if you look at tell me the date on the side of that albino penis envy monotub.
October 26th.
October 26th. So October
26th. Oh, geez.
We're recording this January 14th of 2021. So on October 26th of 2020, that's when I put in the spawn with the casing and started the process in the monotub. For those of you that don't know, the monotub is the incubator for the fruiting, for the growing of the actual mushroom. So it's been, almost 3 months?
Yeah.
And I've gotten maybe a little bit here and there, but not like one true harvest out of it.
Right.
So it's very temperamental. I'm trying some, like I showed you earlier, I'm trying to put the casing and the spawn in an actual grow bag and have the fruiting done in the grow bag.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see if that produces better results. But it's supposedly, according to people online, it's one of the more difficult strains to cultivate.
All right. And but more potent?
And more potent. Well, according to this article that I found, thank you, Google, I found this article, and it talks about what are the differences among magic mushroom strains and their trips. And it talks about towards the end, hold on, penis envy. There we go. It says here that penis envy has an interesting history. It's theorized the strain was isolated from Amazonian P. cubensis, another popular strain, the PES Amazonian that I was growing. There are many strains, albino penis envy, uncut penis envy. All the variations have characteristics which are clearly distinct from other cubensis strains, other psilocybin mushrooms, consisting of substantially higher potency, 30 to 50%.
Whoa.
So I didn't know this. That mystical experience, that rebirth that I had, that was 4.5 grams of penis envy.
Whoa.
So if it's 30 to 50% more potent, I went on a journey, man.
Yeah.
So it's harder to cultivate, but maybe the juice is worth the squeeze?
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. It says extremely thick, dense stems, pale, underdeveloped caps, making them somewhat resemblant of the organ for which they were named, a.k.a. the penis. So, yeah, rock on. I'm going to continue harvesting penis envy, and I'll do my own experimentation.
That sounds great. Why do you only have one of them going right now?
Because a lot of the jars never amounted to anything.
Right.
So I've had experience, bad experiences with penis envy at every phase of cultivation.
Oh, man. Yeah. Okay.
Once I get the recipe down, and I've seen people online, they use hydrogen peroxide and weird things in their casing mixture.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if I'm going to head down that path. But once I do figure out what makes it work, I'll actually write it down and we'll share with the listening audience.
Have you tried coffee yet? In any of these?
Good question. Yes, I did start introducing coffee into both my casing, and I was already putting it in the spawn.
Oh, okay.
But I started putting about a cup of ground coffee in the casing. So when you introduce the boiling water for pasteurization, it just kind of, you know, melts it all in and makes it hopefully more rich with nitrogen.
Gotcha.
That's the goal, is to introduce some nitrogen, like manure would.
Right.
But I'm not using manure. Fuck manure.
Right. I don't know. That stuff he produced with the goat shit.
Oh, the goat shit. What? I can't remember the name of that Instagram handle, but dear God, the goat shit.
Just like a fist.
I don't know if I'm ready. Like, then I have to go buy a goat, and I have to, like, nurture a goat. It becomes a really cumbersome process at that point. So I'm hoping that I can recreate the goat shit experience minus the goat shit.
Do people ever utilize compost?
Good question. Yes. And that's one of the things, like with mushrooms, there's so many opportunities to kind of deal with waste with fungus, with fungi. And people are absolutely growing mushrooms in compost. I'm not there yet. Like, I don't really want to, I don't like getting my hands too dirty. I don't know if I want to be in and out of compost all day. But if you were living in a fully self-sustained, like, you know, use everything kind of environment, it makes total sense to grow your mushrooms out of compost.
Sure.
I just don't know the right ratio of nutrients and stuff, but hell yeah.
Yeah, right.
Now, I would love to hear some feedback from you if you want to take that on, but I'm not there yet.
All right.
Yeah, I'll take that into consideration. Maybe not.
We get a little extra time.
So let's actually talk about the monotub. I don't think we've gone through the monotub construct with the listening audience, which, again, I hope is vast. Don't know, can't verify. I hope it's vast. I probably could verify, but I'm a little scared to look at the number. So a monotub is essentially your fruiting environment where your mushrooms are going to ultimately grow. So any real sizable Tupperware container will do. I can't remember the exact size of these. Do you remember the size when you bought your still air box?
I think it was bigger than the 34 liter, but...
Okay. Well, anyways, this is it's a medium-sized Rubbermaid container. It doesn't have to have a clear lid if you're going to make it fully self-contained. If you're going to have it in a room where your lighting source is indirect, then you want to have a clear lid so it gets more exposure to light.
Okay.
But in this environment, because I actually adhered the lights to the underside of the lid, I don't need to have a clear lid.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Unlike plants, they don't actually utilize the light for growth or anything like that. But so why would indirect light be less advantageous, or less light be less advantageous?
Well, supposedly, according to, you know, my research, you need 10 to 12 hours of light for the mushrooms. It doesn't have to be direct light. It can be indirect, but it needs to be present. So it depends on what lighting source you have. For me, I equip my mono tubs with an independent light source.
Okay.
But if I had all my tubs in like a room that had its own light source that could be plentiful enough for all the tubs, then I could just have clear lids and it would suffice that way. So it really just depends on your setup.
Makes sense.
But if you do want a fully self-contained mono tub, the way I did it is you cut two, I'd say, inch diameter holes on either side of the mono tub for ventilation, and you put polyfill. Polyfill is the inside of a stuffed teddy bear. It's that that stuffing shit, and it's super cheap online. What was it, like $11 for a bag or something?
Something like that.
Yeah. So you basically create these air exchange holes on the side of your mono tub, and your carbon dioxide will exchange through those holes.
Right.
So you can see here the ones I have. I have two holes on either side. I have some duct tape around those holes to kind of grip
the polyfill.
Yeah. And every time you reuse a mono tub, I like to replace the polyfill. It gets kind of dirty. I also have the lights used. I use zip tie to adhere the lights to the underside, some LED lights to the underside of the lid. I have a CPU fan that has a USB connection that I fix to the side to offer fresh air intake. And then I have a humidifier that I use with a tube to introduce distilled water. So you can find them online. If you look online, you can see what the mono tub construct, all the breakdown of all the steps and everything. But really what you want is an environment that is going to be moisture rich, very humid as you can make it. And has light and the ability to exchange both oxygen and carbon dioxide.
Well, since you brought up humidity, what kind of timeline do you use for the humidifier?
I love that question. So I've been working on perfecting that. What I've been doing is every couple hours, I think it's every two to three hours, I'll turn on my humidifiers for the mono tubs for a minute to introduce a solid stream of humidity, moisture, mist.
Ah, there you go.
We'll go with mist. One syllable. It offers a constant stream of mist to keep the chamber moist, and then I'll turn a fan on to kind of blow that around and disperse it throughout the tub. So really, what I'm trying to do is just get as much of that mist in the air and as dispersed as possible, just to keep it to simulate what you might find in like a swampy area, you know, a real humid part of Florida, something like that. So it's been something I've had to tinker with, but I will I'll put some numbers down once I get around to putting a website together. Right now it's kind of in the old noggin.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So yeah, mono tub. You can also fruit inside the grow bag, which we were talking about earlier, Chris. It's another option. I don't have as much experience there, but I'm hoping to do some test cases and report some findings back. Maybe it offers better yields. I'm not really sure yet.
Sure.
So Chris, let's talk about you. We had some mishaps with some spawn bags, and I feel partially responsible.
No,
let's tell the listening audience what happened.
Well, we were trying to make some spawn bags.
You bought the bags online, right?
Bought the bags online.
Where'd you buy them? Unofficial sponsor.
I think Amazon.
All right, Amazon sells grow bags.
Yeah,
or spawn bags.
Spawn bags.
Yeah,
yeah. So we tried to inoculate them with the spores, but we didn't use a still air box for some reason.
Got cocky.
We did. We did. We flew too close to the sun. Icarus.
Got fucking cocky. So, yes, I feel partially responsible. Everything you do, and we talked to Andrew in the last episode, everything you do, you have to be meticulous with the decontamination and the sterilization. So I dropped the ball because I really should have led the effort to use a still air box. I didn't have the flow hood yet, but I should have definitely mandated. No, right? That flow hood's beautiful.
It is.
So we should have used the still air box for every phase of that inoculation, and we didn't.
Sure.
We dealt with mold, and we just didn't really accomplish our goal in any way.
Yep. Had one bag make it out of the six that I had, and how many did you?
Oh man, I had a bunch that were contaminated. Almost all of them. Bottom line is, we wasted some spawn.
Yeah.
I wasted some liquid culture, which I'm not super worried about. But what we need to do next time we go through the process is, I need to figure out the right way to introduce liquid culture. Obviously, inside the still air box, mm-hmm. but something we did, I don't know that it's just the atmosphere, something we did with the inoculating with liquid culture wasn't up to snuff. So
okay.
I need to go through the process and just make sure that, you know, if I was missing something, that I correct it and just have a consistent, repeatable process.
Sure.
Right now, it's a little, it's kind of a little loose.
Right.
Yeah.
All these processes started that way.
Yeah. Amateur mycology, you know?
Yeah.
So sorry about that, Chris. Next time we're gonna make a much more concerted effort to get good workable mushrooms out of that.
Absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Sounds like a good time to interrupt and provide you with a health segment from Wifey Jill. Here we go.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. What do you have for us today?
We are going to discuss cordyceps.
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 Spelled CORDYCE. P.S. Not that you'll need to spell that, but
yeah, like Cordy. Yeah, the Y is a little light. You don't have to enunciate the Y.
For shizzle.
Cordyceps. So this one is a type of medicinal mushroom, with a ton of antioxidant and anti-inflammatory benefits. It is a long used in traditional Chinese medicine, and there are more than 400 species of cordyceps. Mostly which are native to the Asian areas, China, Korea, Nepal, Thailand, Vietnam, and Bhutan.
Interesting.
Yeah. So these are long finger-like bodies. So they almost look like...
Like Cheetos, right?
Like Cheetos, but like what are the things in the bottom at the bottom of the ocean?
Oh, like anemones?
Anemones, yeah. Or, they kind of look like that.
Yeah, like sea coral, flowy kind of stuff.
Yeah, like skinnier than your fingers, worm-like, if you will. But yeah, like they have pins, if you will.
Yeah, it's when I first saw it, it looks exactly like a very thin Cheeto. Like
they have the color of the Cheeto.
Yeah, it's like a flamey.
It's that bright orange, flamey, wavy.
Yeah.
Yeah, very skinny Cheetos or like sperm that are stuck.
What's on your mind?
I mean, it looks like sperm.
All right, I'll take it. By the way, we are at 20 weeks.
We're 20 weeks. 20 weeks grown. We're halfway there.
Awesome. Yeah. Baby's healthy, so that's why I am smiling. Been smiling for a while now.
Yeah, you're so excited. Well, we're both excited, but you're just beaming.
I am going to be a girl dad to the fucking 40th
Hashtag
power.
Girl dad.
43rd power, yeah. So, yes, looks like a Cheeto. And you can actually buy the – I'm speaking really loud. You can actually buy the spores – not spores, but you can buy liquid culture of cordyceps if you want to do homegrown recipes. So there's a place online. If you just search on Amazon, you can actually buy the cordyceps liquid culture syringes for your own inoculation and homegrown. And I think the recipe that they use is like a rice-based recipe. So I can add some links down the road, but look up like cordyceps home cultivation and they'll give you the recipe and like how to proceed with it.
Nice.
And back to you.
And it's something you haven't started home growing quite yet.
No, I mean, there's a whole separate strategy in terms of like the container you use with pasteurization, and it uses silicone bags and some other stuff. So I've been so consumed with like the various strains that I've been playing with, I haven't had a chance to give it its due diligence. I will, though, and report back.
Yeah, I know this is one you've been talking up for quite some time. So I'm eager to get that one going.
Hell yeah.
Fun fact, wild cordyceps in China, for a kilogram, often cost in excess of $20,000.
Holy.
So this is highly touted. It is, sought out for. And most of the supplements today are made from an engineered fungal culture that has the same biological characteristics of the mushroom. So
wait, so 20 grand for a kilo?
For a kilogram.
Yeah, so that's... I don't know what the going rate for heroin is. I haven't done heroin ever.
Ooh, this probably has to be way more than that.
Yeah, right?
Well,
like,
heroin's,
I mean,
cheap, right? Like,
I don't know.
From the shows we watch, it's like you can get it for $20.
For $20.
Like a hit or something.
Yeah. Well, we don't know that. We clearly don't know the jargon. Like, if we showed up, people would be like cops.
Just from, like, the Law and Order and Chicago PD and all of that stuff.
I know. I've always thought it was fascinating, the people that had, like, the heroin kits, though. You know, like the, it's like a tiny little doctor pouch that has, like, the syringes and a little bicycle tube, and a lot of tears. A lot of tears.
Like a lighter.
Yeah, a spoon. Like, there's three spoons in the china cabinet instead of four.
The thing you have to tie around your arm.
Right.
So you can get your veins to pop.
That is just, I mean, I use some paraphernalia when I dabble with my my homegrown stuff, but dear God, I can't imagine having that level of paraphernalia to try to get some sort of high. It just seems uber cumbersome.
I mean, let's be honest. People have bongs that are like 4 feet tall.
Touche, touche.
So it's just the maybe extremity of it.
Yeah. I mean, I do take offense to you putting marijuana and heroin in the same category, but
I'm just saying, when you're saying size
does,
like,
kind of matter.
Well, I mean, there's like water bongs and giant, huge bong. I mean, there's just,
yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt. All right, so we got off on a tangent.
Completely different.
But 20 grand for a key. So if you have
20 grand.
You're in possession of some premium, hopefully uncut shit. So run with that.
Yeah. So those are, again, wild cordyceps in China can fetch, you know, in excess of 20K.
Man.
For a K. And so, yeah. So health benefits. Getting back there. So cordyceps is often touted as a natural energy booster. It can protect against health problems such as asthma, depression, diabetes, fatigue, upper respiratory tract infections, fight against high cholesterol. So there are a lot of benefits surrounding it from a health perspective.
Yeah.
I will say, if you are diabetic or if you're taking any type of blood thinners, be advised when adding cordyceps to your regimen, because it can plummet your blood pressure, your blood levels, your blood sugar levels. So just be aware that you want to talk to your doctor first before just adding that in.
Good point. And just another thing, when it's consumed, it's not usually consumed in its original form, right? It's usually ground into some sort of powder like reishi or some of the other medicinal mushrooms we talked about.
Correct. Yeah. So I would say that the supplements that at least we've seen have been more in a pill form.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we go back to them being more genetically manufactured, because you can biologically reproduce these without having the original cordyceps used.
Gotcha.
But I mean, like your homegrown kits, you know, you can still grow them at home and then look up safe ways of cooking and ingesting them that way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
By the way, that's an appearance from Mook. We hope that never happens, but sometimes, most of the time, it does. Back to you.
Yeah. So something also interesting, cordyceps was popularized, for athletic performance in the early 90s. A few Chinese track and field athletes actually shattered multiple world records, and their coach attributed to the cordyceps supplements that it helps increase athletic performance.
You know what? If Lance Armstrong would have gone far east for his medicine.
Oh, he might have gotten away with it.
Yeah.
Because what did he? His was like blood doping or something?
Yeah, he was using, he was doping with blood that had a different oxygen level, I believe. I'm not a bicyclist or a bicycling enthusiast.
But that to me still isn't like drugs. I don't know.
But in that sport, apparently that's the drugs. It's relative to that sport, which most people couldn't care less about.
Yeah. So a study in 2016 by the University of North Carolina, they showed that daily cordyceps supplementation gradually increased your maximum oxygen intake in young adults after 3 weeks. So when we're talking about the health benefits, distance runners or distance athletes in general can, you know, cycle the oxygen faster throughout their body and then, you know, maintain the stamina a lot longer than those who hadn't.
Nice.
So let's see, some additional ones. So some herbalists also believed that cordyceps can help boost libido, protect against cancer, and slow down the aging process.
And all that in a simple mushroom.
Just another mushroom, just packed full of benefits.
And Paul Stamets, I don't know if you read about where Paul Stamets engineered a way to fight insects in the garden using cordyceps.
Oh, that was cordyceps?
Yeah, yeah. He found a way. They can actually grow inside of insects. That can be a fruiting body, I guess, for the spores. So what happened, and I'm paraphrasing here, so if I'm incorrect, I apologize, but basically he tricked the certain insects to taking the spores, consuming the spores, bringing them back into their colonies, and proliferating the mushrooms actually within themselves and in their environment. So they were able to kind of like keep them away and kind of show them that it could be harmful to their community.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's more to read, obviously, and that was a really lousy job paraphrasing, but it's a fascinating story, and there's a number of patents, I believe, associated with the work from the great mycologist Paul Stamets.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Oh, fucking A. I love that dude.
Yeah. So I also found, cordyceps are generally received in pill form. They can be used, you can also get them in dried form where you can make tinctures and extracts.
Wait, what was the first thing you said?
What do you mean?
Tinctures?
Tinctures.
I've never heard of
that. It's like, how do you say it? They're like in these little vials with droppers, and it's almost like an extract that is infused with. I mean, I guess I don't know the difference exactly between an extract and a tincture.
How do you spell that? Because I've never, not reading the right literature, apparently.
It's like puncture, but with a T-I in front.
Fantastic.
Tincture. Yeah.
All right, so the next time you take some CBD from an eyedropper, it's a tincture.
Well, again, I don't know the rules between extracts and tinctures.
Okay. All right, so don't hold me to it.
Yeah, but, I mean, just visually, that's kind of what it is. It's a... something you can add as a dropper and add a certain dosage.
Okay.
But yeah, so you can buy dry hold cordyceps. You can buy them in supplement forms. You can also buy them in powder form. You can add them to smoothies or protein shakes. You can brew them in tea.
They come in a lot of the Folgers coffee. They're starting to produce
part of
them.
Those. Yeah, a lot of the mushroom teas has cordyceps as part of their mushroom blend.
Yeah, there's a place. Remember that place in Santa Fe? What was it?
Oh, the apothecary.
The apothecary. Oh, they had that amazing mushroom coffee tea thing.
Yeah. Well, what did they call theirs?
God, it was great.
It was like a whole array of drinks that had all of these health benefits.
Yeah, Santa Fe.
They were called something.
Just for anybody listening that hasn't traveled to Santa Fe, that's in the western like Denver, Colorado area, or similar. It's awesome, man. There's a lot of great artwork out there. The people were really cool, and there was an apothecary restaurant kind of boutique place that specialized in a lot of herbs and what did they call them? There was some sort of natural booster, some term they used, but it was pretty awesome.
Oh, the aptogenic drinks, like lattes, tonics. Elixirs.
Yeah.
The Elixirs is where...
great spot. It's in, like, downtown Santa Fe. We went...
Like the historic the historic area.
Yeah, we went right at the beginning of COVID to try to go to Meow Wolf out there, which is coming to Denver and is freaking amazing. So we missed that, but at the same time, we got to fall in love with this apothecary. So kudos to them, and we'll make them an unofficial sponsor. Why not?
Yeah, I'm looking at their menu right now, and it's just making me hungry.
So anything else cordycep-wise that the listening audience, which I hope is vastly growing, should know?
I mean, I think we covered a lot of the topics.
Okay.
Again, there's over 400 species of cordyceps, so people, if they wanted to research this and go a little deeper, they can look into the different varieties and the accessibility of those, which ones can be reproduced at home. Something to follow up is, what about the consumption of fresh cordyceps? We didn't come across any research on that.
No. And there's a guy, William Padilla, I believe is his name. He's kind of the expert on cordyceps cultivation. Really well-known guy in the area of mycology and fungi. He has a proven method for cultivation of cordyceps.
There you go.
Yeah, William Padilla.
William Padilla.
So something to look up if you're more curious about, you know, its genesis and, you know, how it's used even more so than what we talked about.
Another just funny side note, the dried cordyceps. It looks like those the dried lo mein noodles you put in your egg drop soup.
Yeah, which are delicious, so don't get them confused. It'd be like drinking a Dr. Pepper, which turns out to be an iced tea. That's not good.
Ooh, that's a big difference.
Terrible, horrible.
Big difference.
Ruins your day. Well, Wifey Jill, thank you so much. That, again, was super educational, and your voice is just intoxicating.
Ah, well, thanks.
Yeah. Do you mind hanging on? I just want to talk about a mushroom that I think is pretty cool, and it's not like a psychedelic mushroom, and it's not a medicinal or a culinary mushroom. It kind of falls somewhere in between, but aesthetically and kind of the its appearance is pretty prominent in society. So the mushroom I want to talk about, it's probably the most famous visually. People are most familiar with this look. It's called the Amanita muscaria, which also is known as fly agaric. And I'm not sure why they have two terms, but Amanita muscaria is the scientific term, and it's fly agaric might be the more generic or more general term.
I mean, but the more popularized term is probably the Mario mushroom.
It's the Mario mushroom, yes. The Mario mushroom, it's the...
Or the mushroom that is like are painted in like fairies and, you know, woodland creature, you know, backdrops.
It is that mushroom. I mean,
yeah, the red top with the white dots.
Red top, white dots. And it's actually the influence for Santa Claus as well, like the color scheme.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I found this article, which people that are familiar with the mushroom probably know this, but there's a correlation between Santa and magic mushrooms, which ties back to this Amanita muscaria. So I think it was just that look and feel was playful, you know, the red and white. So there's more to be said there. I don't want to give you all the ins and outs, but it says here that ultimately, you know, the look and feel of Santa was derived from the fly agaric mushroom.
Oh, that's, well, someone was on some magic mushrooms when they wrote that, I'm
Boom.
Sure.
And it's the most time-honored Christmas classic character. So
yeah.
Thank you, mushrooms. Has anybody said thank you, mushrooms, for bringing us Santa Claus?
I mean,
we're saying it now.
Probably not.
Mazel tov.
You're the first.
I'll plant my flag. So yeah, Amanita muscaria. And so basically it is a mushroom that categorized, I guess, I don't know like where it falls in the fungi category, but it says you can't eat it, you can't consume it directly, you have to boil into some sort of tea, and then it provides you like similar effects as being drunk. So I'm trying to the side effects. It says, of course, Amanita muscaria won't really make you fly, the fly agaric term, but it can definitely inspire a good trip. When taken, the ibotenic acid decarboxylates into muscimol, M-U-S-C-I-M-O-L is the active compound responsible for the psychedelic effect of the mushroom. It's different than other psychedelics and can be sometimes unpredictable. So
this one is more predictable and less unpredictable.
I don't know. It says the side effects include sweating, involuntary movements known as ataxia, dilated pupils, nausea, loss of balance or coordination, drowsiness, and excessive salivation, which sound like all the same side effects from every pharmaceutical commercial we've ever seen on CNN 8,000 times a day. It says the effects generally become noticeable 30 to 90 minutes after taking and will last between 4 to 10 hours. So there's a process to taking it. It's not going to give me like a growing experience mentally, I don't think. It's more of just like a, hey, this is fun kind of thing. But
yeah, and it looks like when you dry them, it increases the potency.
Okay, and that says right here, Amanita muscaria is generally taken after the mushrooms have been dried. It allows the ibotenic acid to convert to muscimol, greatly increasing the potency. So we were actually at the Telluride market.
Farmer's market.
Farmer's market. And the Telluride Mushroom Company, a shout out, unofficial sponsor, just as of now, they had dried fly agaric, parentheses, Amanita muscaria, for sale. So I bought a couple ounces of it, and on the back it says, boil the mushrooms for 15 minutes, strain, do not consume, take the water, and then mix it into a dish. So it doesn't really say anything about what's going to happen to you, but hey, might be worth an experiment. What do you think?
I mean, not me. I'm pregnant.
That's correct. Good. That is the correct answer. That was a trick question. But yes, for the average people listening, I don't think it's a huge risk, but I don't see the real upside other than maybe like, ooh, I felt kind of weird, and I can write that in my journal.
So I would assume that the compounds are going to be water-soluble in this type of mushrooms.
What
so
does that mean?
Meaning that the compounds, the musimol?
Musimol, yeah.
Yeah, the musimol, which contains the drug, if you will.
Correct.
It's going to be water-soluble. So when you boil these mushrooms, when you rehydrate them, it's going to be in the liquid and not in the mushroom.
Gotcha.
You know, minuscule amounts will still reside in the mushroom, but because it's water-soluble, that means that the compound is going to follow the water.
Interesting.
So drinking the water is probably what's going to get you high versus consuming the mushroom itself.
Fantastic. I could not have asked for a better explanation.
Yes.
And that's my girl. That's my boo.
So then the opposite is fat-soluble. So for instance, like THC, marijuana, that's a fat-soluble compound. So when you make brownies, pot brownies, you boil the weed in butter. The butter pulls out the compounds, the THC, and then you use that butter when you make your brownies.
I love it. The science. The science is there.
Yep.
So that's my wifey Jill, the scientist, budding scientist, superstar.
Budding.
I mean, there's more hype around her than Amanda Gordon, the poet laureate
Please,
in the White House.
I am not even close to her. You should strike that. That's
I hope our daughter grows up to be as awesome as Amanda Gordon, by the way.
Amen to that.
Gorman, excuse me. So on that note, we're going to phase out. But Wifey Jill, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
And listening audience, I hope you learned a lot about two new awesome mushrooms. We'll keep this going. Chris wasn't available to do his integration for his experience, his heroic dose, and Katie decided not to share her experience. So when we can harness Chris and get him, you know, 15 minutes of his time, we'll try to get his integration.
Cool.
All right, and we're out. Bye.
Bye. With you.